From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Politicians know how to reach reluctant voters.
What the hell do you have to lose?
It turns out appealing to emotions rather than logic can be a very persuasive strategy. We'll get into the science behind cognitive biases and how they influence politics later. First, last week, our Friday break room crew chewed on a few controversial topics. One of them was, is there a right or wrong way to make a PB&J sandwich?
It needs to be soft yet dry.
That's Kalina Baller of the Real Snobs podcast. Here are your first thoughts on the art of a PB&J. Listener Steve Brown tweeted, mix the ingredients in a bowl, use several types of preserves, then spread on toasted bread. And then Melanie Harper shared her family's recipe. My kiddo eats PB&J on unsalted rice cakes for lunch every day because gluten-free bread doesn't make a good sandwich. I think most people would agree with that, Melanie. You can give us your thoughts. Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. We're also on Twitter, at OST Talk. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Last week, an unexpected cold front slammed most of the East Coast. In Georgia, that was bad news for fruit farmers. Peach and blueberry farmers stand to lose millions of dollars in this late freeze, but something good might come out of it, or as a result of it. Researchers at the University of Georgia have developed an equation that they say will help combat that loss. With me now is one of the researchers, Pam Knox, an agricultural climatologist at the University of Georgia. Hi, Pam.
Good morning, Celeste.
And also joining us by phone is Joe Cornelius, chair of the Georgia Blueberry Commission. Good to have you back, Joe.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Joe, why is a frost like this, why is it so potentially devastating for farmers?
Well, the blooms on the plants and the fruit that's done drop blooms are very tender. It doesn't take but like 31.5 degrees. Or even a frost on an open bloom can damage it and cause it to be unattractive to bees for pollination.
And Pam, one of the reasons why UGA was looking at this was because of the loss in dollars. But what are the sort of the starting points when you begin something like this to say, how can we make a late frost not quite so awful for farmers? What are the things, what are the basis for where you begin?
Well, farmers are looking for ways to try to keep the temperatures up to a more reasonable level so that they don't have damage to the blooms. There's a number of ways that they can do that. One of the most common is irrigation of the fields, for example, blueberry fields. But some other farmers can also use big fans, or they can hire helicopters to come in and stir up the air from higher levels, which is usually warmer than near the ground.
And Joe, how does that work? The irrigation, one would think that if you were putting water on crops and it got really cold, that the plants would freeze. How does the irrigation help?
They actually do freeze, but once you cause ice to completely go around the fruit or the bush, then the temperature in there stays at 31.5. It's the science of releasing BTUs while the ice is forming. It's kind of above my head. Miss Pam, I could describe more of that part of it. The wind machines and the helicopters, you need the conditions right. I mean, you need an inversion layer, which we lost during the night, Wednesday night, Thursday morning. And the temperatures need to stay within each type of tool to combat frost has its parameters. Wind machines and helicopters is probably in the 27 to 29 range with an inversion layer. A lot of fields in South Georgia went to the mid-20s, 23 to 25 degrees. And water is the only overhead solid-set irrigation is the only answer for that. And at 23 degrees, you're getting to the edge of the envelope of what it can do.
A BTU, I want to make sure we don't lose our listeners here. A BTU is a British thermal unit. It's just a unit of heat. And I believe, although Pam can correct me, I think it is the amount of heat that's required to raise 1 pound of water 1 degree Fahrenheit. Is that right, Pam?
I believe that's right.
Okay. So one of the big points of your research in coming up with this equation is dew point. Pam, can you explain what dew point is and how it relates to this problem?
Well, there's actually a couple different measures. The one that we're looking at most is wet bulb temperature, not dew point.
Wet bulb. I want to make sure everyone gets that. The wet bulb is what, right?
Well, let me explain the difference between the two. You have your regular air temperature, which is just the ambient air temperature that's measured with the thermometer. And then there's two different measurements that take into account the humidity in the atmosphere. The dew point temperature is the temperature. If you took a glass of water and put ice in it, and you started to see dew form on the outside of that glass, that would help you to measure the dew point temperature. Although more typically for meteorologists, they measure it with a chilled mirror. And when the mirror doesn't start reflecting the light anymore because there's little drops of water on it, then that's how they measure the dew point. The wet bulb is between the ambient air temperature and the dew point temperature. And the wet bulb temperature is the temperature that you usually feel, for example, if you just took a shower and you jump out and you start to feel that coolness on your skin. So the water is evaporating off your skin and it's cooling off your surface. And the wet bulb temperature is the one that's usually used to help determine when to turn on the irrigation for frost protection.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Pam Knox, an agricultural climatologist at UGA, and they have come up with an equation that might help protect crops against a late freeze. We also have Joel Cornelius with us, chair of the Georgia Blueberry Commission. Pam, this equation attempts to predict the weather, though, right?
No, it takes predictions from the National Weather Service. It tries to make it easier to use for farmers. When you look at weather predictions, typically, you'll get the temperature and the dew point temperature, but you will not get the wet bulb temperature. And since the wet bulb temperature is what you really need to start turning on your irrigation, the equation is designed to take that temperature and the dew point temperature to calculate the wet bulb and then allow the farmers to start their irrigation when it's the most efficient.
Joe, how much of a help could this be if you know in advance what time to start your irrigation in order to protect your crops? How big a help is that?
It can be very helpful. I mean, it cuts down on cost and how much water you're actually putting in the field. I mean, this time of the year, the plants doesn't need as much water as you can put out in one night's frost protection. You create other issues when you just run it for hours on end and really don't need to.
Pam, has this been used by farmers yet? Do you know how effective it has been in the fields?
The equation was just published a few weeks ago, so we haven't had a lot of real field experience yet. I have been working with Renee Allen down in Alma, Georgia, to try to figure out a way to make it more operational, but that's going to be my goal in the next year.
To try and test it out.
Exactly.
And see whether you need to tweak it or not.
Yeah,
right?
And hopefully we'll put it, if we can, we're going to try to put it in the form of an app that people will be able to get on their smartphone.
Joe, what kind of things, I mean, how much do farmers, do you think, stand to lose? Or how much could you lose if the late frost actually, you know, kills off your blueberry crop?
A good bit. I'm looking at 30 acres. It is somewhere between 60 and 90% reduction. Well,
besides, let's say that this equation works exactly the way Pam and her colleagues hope that it does, and that you now have advance notice of when to turn your irrigation to protect your crops. Could that save your entire fields in the future?
Well, it can. The more information you have before you get into an event, the better judgment calls you can make. I mean, people that rented helicopters and had them over their fields, and the fields still ambient temperature went to 23, 24 degrees with no inversion layer. Well, they spent, you know, $600-$700 an hour that gained them nothing. So it's more information you have, the better calls you can make before you get to it.
And can you help me understand why this particular freeze is so potentially damaging? The temperatures at this point are higher than normal, and March isn't a really unusual time to have the kind of cold temperatures. So why are farmers so worried right now about this freeze?
We've had such a warm February that the plants has really advanced, and it's like Ms. Pam said, at certain stages of development, the plants are hardy to certain coldness. Full open bloom is, you know, 27, 28 degrees. You get below 28 and you've pretty much lost everything that's open or fruit formed. If you get to, you know, 25, then you've lost a good bit of your elongated that's not quite open. So, I mean, if we'd have been the plants that have been where we traditionally see our later crops at, they wouldn't have been as damaged as they have been.
Pam, what other questions do you have as we move forward to actually testing this equation in the field to see if it works? What questions do you have that need to be answered?
Well, I think we need to keep in mind that irrigation or other kinds of frost protection is not always going to work. If the air is really, really dry, then even irrigation is not going to keep the temperature at an appropriate point, because you just have to put so much water on that it's going to ice up the plants and cause a lot of damage. So it will also help farmers to identify when it's probably not worth it to do that. I mean, this year's frost was later than we might have expected because it was so warm over the winter, but it really was just about an average time of year for a last frost. So it wasn't that unexpected, but I think it really will help us in terms of trying to decide what's the optimum time to irrigate if you're going to, and maybe when it's not appropriate to do it.
And what other tools, Joe, do you think farmers, especially those in Georgia, need? Besides an equation like this, what else could farmers use?
Well, I mean, each farmer needs to understand what's going on in his field. And, you'll have fields that has cold pockets in it, some fields that will stay 2 or 3 degrees above, the low points. So each individual field and each individual farmer needs to understand what's going on in his field.
What's the worst case scenario here, Joe?
The worst case right now would be 80-90% loss of our late May, June crop. We're still assessing. I mean, this thing happened, we actually had a frost Friday morning last week, so we're still trying to calculate what's happened, how bad it's happened.
When will you know?
Probably by the end of this week, you'll be able to really start counting on what's there or not there. Even if the bloom is still there, say it was an elongated bloom that wasn't damaged by frost, that doesn't mean part of the internal parts of the berry itself was not damaged. So, even if your field right now looks like you've only had a 40% loss, you can still have, another 10, 15, 18% fall off.
And because Georgia, I think, is still the largest producer of blueberries in the country, that could mean a higher price for our blue fruit.
It could. It could change and help the industry that way, yes, ma'am.
That is George Cornelius. He's chair of the Georgia Blueberry Commission. We also spoke with Pam Knox, an agricultural climatologist at the University of Georgia. She helped develop an equation that hopes to fight the loss of blueberry crops following a late freeze like we had. Joe and Pam, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Just ahead, why do we have so much trouble accepting the truth? First, though, following Ebola and measles around the world with a camera. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta do serious business. They save lives and eradicate sickness, but the CDC is also in show business. In its 70-year history, it has captured the imagination of TV writers and filmmakers. GBB's Sean Powers takes us on a quick tour through the CDC's movie career.
We're 5 minutes into this movie, and there's already a dead body.
Drum? Nah, shot twice. Must have crawled on this thing.
Recognize him?
Nah, he ain't from around here. Some kind of foreigner.
These poor cops think this unsolved murder is the worst of their problems. They're worried about bullet holes when they should be worried about the bubonic plague.
I'm Dr. Reed of the United States Public Health Service, and one of the jobs of my department is to keep plague out of this country.
You know, if he's here, it's not good.
Now, I may be an alarmist, I may be entirely wrong about the whole matter, but I've seen this disease work. And I'm telling you, if it ever gets loose, it can spread over the entire country.
Dr. Reed is indeed an alarmist.
What can we do?
He's the main character in the 1950 film noir Panic in the Streets.
We can have them watched, we know who they are, all but one. The man who killed him, or men.
This was one of the first movies to feature an agency like the CDC, which was 4 years old the year this movie came out. Well, an expert on the plague won't help us now. No, what we need is an expert on movies.
My name is Stephen Brown. I am chief film critic for SilverScreenCapture.com.
Stephen lives in Atlanta and reviews movies as a hobby on his website. I asked him to compile a list of some of the classics inspired by the CDC.
In various forms over the years, in cinema culture, CDC has become less a specific government organization than a state of mind. There's always been intrepid scientists trying to look for ways to fight against time, fight against the virus, fight against the pod people.
I'll be damned. No wonder they didn't bleed. It's clotted throughout the entire system. 5 quarts of blood turned to powder.
In theory, I suppose a single organism could do it.
But in fact, there isn't an organism on Earth.
You mean there didn't used to be?
That's a scene from the 1971 science fiction thriller The Andromeda Strain, which was based on a novel by Michael Crichton. A team of scientists tries to stop a deadly alien virus that wipes out a small town. Stephen Brown says, in these earlier films that tackle CDC-esque issues, you don't hear CDC mentioned by name.
Only in the past 2 or 3 decades has the CDC actually been called out as something that people discuss and talk about as an entity, shorthand for the disease-fighting warriors.
And no one represents disease-fighting warriors more than our brain-bashing, skull-crushing heroes in The Walking Dead. The show actually features an episode at the CDC where a lone researcher tries to learn more about what's turned humanity into bloodthirsty zombies. One of the main characters finds out the key to the outbreak.
What? Of the CDC, Jenner told me. Whatever it is, we all carry it.
In recent years, zombie flicks like World War Z, I Am Legend, and 28 Days Later have mixed together the undead and public health in an end-of-the-world recipe. CDC Museum Director Judy Gant says it's interesting how these depictions resonate with audiences.
We've had people come into the museum and seriously ask, not kids, but adults, seriously ask, where do you keep the zombies? And we have laughed and said, oh, you know, that's just TV. No, you can tell me, where really are the zombies?
But accuracy matters in some plots. Like in the 2011 movie Contagion, which was about the race to stop an airborne virus.
Hello?
Hello? Mr. Barnes?
Yes.
This is Dr. Mears from the Centers for Disease Control. I believe you may have had contact with Beth Emhoff last week.
The filmmakers behind Contagion talked with the CDC about accuracy.
How are you feeling today?
Pretty cruddy, to be honest. Head is pounding. I probably picked up some sort of bug.
Where are you right now?
Other filmmakers give Kate Fulb a call. She oversees Hollywood Health and Society at the University of Southern California. Think of it as the arm between Hollywood and the CDC.
If you're a half-hour show, you actually have about 22 minutes to tell your entire story. And within that time, you've got people to kill and murders to be solved and love stories to, you know, there's a lot of other stuff going on besides the health information.
But Kate says that doesn't mean health information should take a back seat. She and her team provide the entertainment industry with accurate and timely information about things like public health research, climate change, and CDC clothing and equipment.
Viewers actually learn a lot about health information through their favorite television programs. And they actually learn this information and believe it more so from popular narrative programs than they do from the news or commercials or PSAs.
And that leaves the question, what will be Hollywood's next public health crisis? Will it be the race to stop the Zika virus or Ebola, or an even greater menace that we haven't dreamed up yet?
We're heading to the CDC. If there's anything left, it's got to be there, don't you think?
For GPB News, I'm Sean Powers in Atlanta.
CDC now, specifically at the CDC Museum, there's a collection of photos by Jim Gaffney. For 30 years, Jim has documented the center's scientific breakthroughs, its facilities, its history. He's been behind the scenes as public health nightmares have unfolded before our eyes.
A couple years ago, Devin Lenz, bit by a mosquito, took a nap, woke up a couple hours later, couldn't sit up or move his legs.
Everything we look at with this virus seems to be a bit scarier than we initially thought.
You know, seeing a truck cart away 10 bodies of people who died from Ebola, I can't imagine what someone is thinking who has arrived there for treatment.
An exhibit of Jim's photos is on display now at the center's museum. This exhibit is called A Lens on CDC, and it runs until the end of May in the museum near Emory University. Jim joins me now from the CDC's Atlanta headquarters. Welcome.
Thank you.
So I'm sure it's difficult to look back 30 years, but what did you think when you first got this assignment and they told you you were going to be photographing scientists in suits and insects?
Well, I thought it was the best job in the world, and I still do. I really enjoyed every minute of it and learned something every day. So for me, it's been sort of a dream job.
How do you go about, because you take a really wide variety of photographs, meaning that you have some landscapes there, you have photographs, portraits of people, but then you have these extremely detailed close-up photos of lice and ticks. How do you sort of handle all these very, very different assignments?
Well, I have a variety of types of equipment, and I guess the trick is to know what to take with you to shoot a certain job. And one of the interesting things about this exhibit is that each of the photos represents an assignment or a request from a scientist or a communicator for that specific image or that type of image. So the thought of an exhibit never really occurred to me, because each of these images is so diverse, like you mentioned.
So you work with a lot of things which are secret and have to be kept under wraps at the CDC. But can you tell me a story about an assignment that you got that ended up being really interesting or ended up resulting in great photos?
Oh, there are so many. I'll just mention I don't do most of the general photography, but I did get a call and told me that the call asked me to report and document Prince Andrew's visit. And, of course, that sort of stands out in your mind. I've never met royalty before. And although I'm a scientific photographer and I do mainly laboratory and specimen photography, that day I happened to be available to shoot a tour, and it caught me off guard, but I really enjoyed it, and that really is one that stands out in my mind. But there are so many. I've been asked to go on a trapping expedition to document scientists collecting rats and mice and dissecting them. So it's just always something a little different each day.
And you sometimes end up taking photographs of world leaders.
Yes. I mentioned Prince Andrew, but recently, the most recent visit that I recall is Well, senators and congressmen are visiting almost weekly, but President Obama was here last 2 years ago, and that was quite an experience, with starting with the Secret Service visits and their concern for his safety. And the campus was shut down during his visit. It was a bit difficult to shoot, actually. We were incorporated with the press, and it was difficult to get around and shoot what you wanted to shoot, but that was quite an experience.
So how do you, what is more important when you're taking these photographs? Clarity, the ability to see everything in the image clearly, or beauty?
Well, I'm not an artist, so I think for me the
I bet some people would argue that.
Well,
some
I'll
of the photos
just say
are
this.
Very beautiful.
Well, thank you. The thing is, there is beauty in nature, and I'm lucky enough to see that, and I'm able to record that and share it. But to me, the important thing is, for instance, I'm just now shooting some ticks for a very dedicated scientist who works with rickettsial diseases. And the object is to record the markings on the tick. And it is a beautiful, I know it's a lot of people think it's a disgusting critter, but it is beautiful in its own way. But my object is to show it as it would appear to the observer, and that way they can recognize it. And it also helps illustrate articles. This scientist, who is one of the best that I've worked with here at CDC, is constantly being published, and we provide the images for the articles, for the journal articles.
And you mentioned rickettsial, just in case someone didn't understand what that is. Those are a class of infections caused by a certain kind of bacteria like spotted or typhus fever. But
right.
Yeah, you end up photographing scientists, especially doing their work. And I imagine there has to be some not only challenge, because I've seen some of your photos where it must have been difficult to not have the light glaring off of their masks, their plastic masks that they wear here. But also, I wonder whether you were ever afraid of the diseases and the insects that you were coming in contact with.
Not really. Don't really think about it. Most of the insects that I photograph are lab-raised. So it's not, there's just no chance that they're going to be infected. I do shoot insects in the wild. Mosquitoes, for instance, if I am looking for a particular species like the Aedes albopictus, which is the Asian tiger mosquito, then I'll usually go out in my backyard or somewhere along a creek, and they're so easy to find, I just photograph them there. And there is a possibility they might be carrying something, but in my mind, it's negligible, and the thought of getting an image sort of obliterates any fear.
So one of your more well-known photographs is of a mosquito, an Aedes aegypti, which is they're known as the yellow fever mosquito. And it looks like in that photo it's resting on skin. Is that your skin that we see?
Yes, it is. I have been photographing mosquitoes for a very long time, and I've tried different strategies. And at one time, I would try to photograph a mosquito on someone else's skin, but it became clear early on that I would do much better at focusing if the mosquito is on my own skin. And so once the mosquito starts feeding, I actually do the focusing by moving the mosquito back and forth and in and out of the range of focus, or the plane of focus.
So in order to get these photos of mosquitoes that you've taken, you need to get a lot of mosquito bites, right?
I do, but they don't bother me. It's interesting. I know people who swell up and itch terribly, but I've never been bitten where I had a reaction like that. I do on occasion with certain exotic mosquitoes, I'll get just a little red dot, but other than that, there's no reaction. I'm very lucky.
And are you holding the camera with one hand while you take these photos?
Sometimes I am. More often, the camera is mobilized or steadied by a tripod or possibly a copy stand. I have a macro setup that's very, very rigid. And sometimes I do take that into the field or a tripod and set it up. As you can imagine, a tripod with the camera, and then I would in the field, and I would encourage a mosquito to feed, and then the camera is already.
How do you encourage them to feed? You just put your arm out there?
Yes, and in some places along the creek near our home, you don't have to encourage too much, but the trick is to cover all but the skin you want them to feed on, so they will go to the lowest hanging fruit, so to speak, and then the camera is already pre-focused and set up, and then once the mosquito starts feeding, then I know where to place my finger in front of the lens.
Man.
And move it back and forth.
That would not be the job for me, Jim. I am glad that you do it instead. That is Jim Gaffney. He is a photographer for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He's documented the CDC's work for the last 30 years, and a collection of his work is on display at the David J. Censor CDC Museum. The exhibit runs until May 26. You'll find a gallery of Jim's photographs at gpbnews.org. Jim, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Just ahead, when was the last time you read a fact and changed your mind? I bet it's been a while. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. No human being is free of bias. We're mostly unaware of them, though. Politicians are not, though, and they use the unconscious biases of their voters to convince us what is true and what is false, and vice versa. Here to talk about this, we have from Penn State, Media Studies Professor Shyam Sunder. Shyam, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Can you explain what an unconscious bias is? If we're unconscious, how do we even detect them?
Well, the reason it's unconscious is we do not detect them. We go about life letting these biases play a role in the way we consume content as well as in the way we look at things. This is why we practice selective exposure, which is we look at only certain things that interest us. And the reason they interest us is because they play on our implicit inbuilt biases. And so we tend to look for things that are consonant with our worldview, with our background and our prior experiences. This is called confirmation bias. We are looking for confirmation of whatever we already believe in.
And okay, so if we're unaware that we have all of these things, and I assume you're talking about everybody, every
That's
single
right.
human being has unconscious biases, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So how does a scientist detect them? How do you know I have them?
So we will look for people's background, and then we will give them content that either is consonant with their background or dissonant with their background, and then we see if there is a greater preference for consonant content versus that which is dissonant.
So you're going to tell me things that I'm primed to agree with?
Right. First, I will find out about your background. And
right.
then I'll say, okay, you're of this kind of political persuasion or you have this kind of prior experience. And then based on that, I will construct content that I think will go down easy with your worldview, and also construct content that might be somewhat distant from your worldview. And I will provide you with both types of content, with equal amount of, play in terms of headline size and whatnot. There should be no other biases except the fact that the content is different. And I would do the same with a number of different people with different worldviews. In fact, people who have the opposite worldview of what you do. And then I find out if indeed there is a systematic difference.
All right, let me bring into this conversation Kennesaw State psychology professor Roxanne Donovan. Hi, Roxanne.
Hi, how are you, Celeste?
So we're talking about this in terms of generalities. Let me try to get more specific. Let's say, for example, that I'm from California, and so you decided to test whether I think alfalfa sprouts belong in a sandwich. They do.
Just to be clear, right?
Right, but you're testing to see if I have an unconscious bias because I grew up in a state that eats alfalfa sprouts, right? And so you're going to try to find out if somebody from Iowa would totally disagree with that. Is that relatively accurate?
Yep, that's exactly how it works.
So what is a confirmation bias? Is that what we're saying, that it's confirming something I already believe?
Confirmation bias is when we look for information that already helps us go towards something that we've already thought. So I believe that alfalfa is necessary on a sandwich, right? So then I look for all this information that says alfalfa is wonderful, it's nutritious, it's great.
Right.
And I say, ha ha, this is why alfalfa needs to be on a sandwich. I'm in Iowa and I think, oh, alfalfa stinks. And then I look for information that says it tastes bad, it's not as nutritious as we think it is, it's
right.
not as nutritious as spinach. So
am
I say,
also
aha.
ignoring the stuff that goes against what I believe?
Oh, exactly. In fact, I'm not even seeking it out, but when I find it, I will interpret the data to support my preconceived notions.
Okay, so the reason we're talking about this, obviously, is because this has come up quite a bit in our recent politics. And one of the things, Shyam Sunder, is that people say that that Donald Trump is especially adept, very good at exploiting this. How does someone exploit an unconscious bias?
Well, he has a kind of a certain understanding of what a large swath of the Midwest American public in general are looking for in terms of the political talking points and things like that. And that's what he went about doing during his campaign. So he was speaking to them in terms of certain issues that were dear to their heart, regardless of whether they were the centerpieces of his policy. So every politician does this in a way, but Donald Trump, I think, is especially adept at was at least during his campaign, at bringing to the fore those issues that mattered most to many of the Midwest workers, the so-called Rust Belt, and also in the South he had a slightly different. So it's all about messaging that is specific to groups in different parts of the country.
And sometimes politicians, this is not isolated to either political party, both of them, all of them do this to some
right.
extent or another. But to some extent, what they're able to do is something that happens in all kinds of arenas. And it's the reason why we're afraid to go swimming, right, Roxanne? It's the reason why we think that we might get eaten by sharks if we're swimming in the Atlantic Ocean. It's something called the availability heuristic. What does that mean?
It's our tendency to prioritize information that comes to mind most easily. So if I've seen Jaws, I'm going to think that being attacked by a shark is highly likely because that image of that movie is in my head.
Sticks with you.
It sticks with me. So when I think water and I think safety, what pops into my head is the shark attack. Even though data show that it's highly, very, very highly unlikely that I'm going to be attacked by a shark in the water. But because that information is coming to my head, then I'm going to misattribute, be illogical about my odds of being attacked by a shark.
So what I don't understand here, Shyam, is why we would allow this information to cross over. And by that I mean, it's not surprising that this movie Jaws would stick in our heads, right? It's designed to do that. But why would we then, our brains, conflate that with a factual news item?
Well, the reality is that we are living in an information overload situation. So all of us are so-called cognitive misers. You know, social psychologists talk about us expending only so much mental energy as is necessary. So we will not seek out all the full truth or the most comprehensive information on any given topic. Instead, what we will do is, find the shortest cut, so to speak. So the availability heuristic basically is something that comes to our mind. You know, the prevalence of shark attacks comes to your mind, and or because of its vividness of portrayal in the media, and that's what makes it more available to us. And if it is available, then we inflate its probability in our daily lives. And likewise, anything that has a very vivid imagery in the media especially is going to stick with us. And so because we are cognitive misers, we are not going to do independent research to find, you know, to find all kinds of corroborating information or even counterfactual information. Instead, we will go with that which is readily available in our minds.
So this suggests, Roxanne, that we're not actually talking about a malfunction of the brain, that this is actually a survival technique, an ability to deal with a deluge of information. Is that accurate?
And that's one theory, that there is so much input that our brain is exposed to that it we are required to whittle that down so that we are able to survive in the environment. And one of the ways that we do that is our brain takes shortcuts or tricks, biases, cognitive biases, in order to help us make decisions, quick decisions that will help us survive, or at least did back in the day.
But the danger, of course, is that they're easily exploited.
They are easily exploited, and it seems like in this political climate, it is especially exploited, because when we fear, when we're under threat, when we're stressed, when we're angry, we're more likely to rely on our prejudices and our preconceived beliefs, even if they're flawed.
If you're just joining me, I'm talking with Kennesaw State Psychology Professor Roxanne Donovan. We're talking about cognitive bias and how that translates into politics. Also with us is Penn State Media Studies Professor Shyam Sundar. Then one of the ways that this is, it's not just modern, because Shyam, we're also talking about a phrase, the whole phrase welfare queen is an example of this, of the availability heuristic, right? This mental shortcut that takes us to some, it was a made up story that Ronald Reagan used, and yet it persists to today. What makes a story like that so stick in our, not only our history, but our minds, but it makes it so lasting?
Yeah, these are what we call exemplars. You know, these specific stories and, in fact, specific profiles of people are exemplars that, in fact, even media use. You know, when you go out and report a story, what you want is a good quote, a person who exemplifies that story in a significant, vivid way. And, you know, those of us who study online news or even regular news for that matter, we know that storytelling is enhanced by powerful examples. And that's why we go after quotes, we go after people who can tell the story for us instead of relying primarily on dry facts or statistical data put out by government agencies. So when we have a story, even you guys get a piece of data from a government agency saying, you know, there are as many as 7% of the Atlanta's population that is on drugs, for example, what you would try and do is go and get some quotes or do some profiles of people who are in that 7%. But what happens is by focusing on that 7%, you're ignoring the 93%. And at a later point in time, when people who have heard your story think about this issue of drugs, they will tend to exaggerate the prevalence much beyond 7%. And that's what we call in the media field as exemplification effect. And that's primarily driven by the availability heuristic, and also by a related heuristic called representativeness heuristic, which is the idea that that exemplar represents the larger population, which in fact is false because, as you know, news people go after exemplars that are unique. You know, the whole man bites dog paradigm that we follow in news, which is the idea that you don't report that which is usual, we only report that which is unusual. But then when reporting that which is unusual, we also forget the fact that psychologically people are processing those things as reflections of the true state of affairs in the world.
And Roxanne, some of these things are so persistent that they have influenced policy today. For example, the crime bill that came in under Clinton, and Hillary Clinton has since apologized for her use of the word super predator, which was supposed to describe a remorseless criminal, young criminal, that actually did not ever exist and ended up disproportionately affecting African Americans. But the idea of that, persists today. How easily is it to create something like that, just that feeds into all the things we're talking about, feeds into our confirmation biases, feeds into our availability heuristic and what he's calling the miserliness of our data production? How easy is that?
It's actually pretty easy. We have a bias that we haven't talked about yet, which is a tendency to group people into us versus them categories. That's called in-group, out-group bias. And it's easy for us to process information if we see ourselves in groups. And we have an in-group favoritism bias, so we see people in our group better than those in the out-group. And we also have a tendency to clump out-group members together, see them as less individuals and more as a group. So if you're thinking about what underlies prejudice, so hostility toward a group, right? In-group, out-group has to be the foundation. So if you have hostility toward a group, and you're trying to squash that, because in our society, at least previously, it wasn't a good idea to show your prejudice. So you're using cognitive energy to minimize behaving in ways consistent with that prejudice, so behaving in discriminatory ways. And then someone shows you a picture, say you have a prejudice against Black people, you think they're criminals, right? You're trying really hard not to show that prejudice. Someone shows you a picture of a super predator, and that happens to be a Black man, then all of a sudden you have justification to express that prejudice. And when we have justification, we are more likely to behave in prejudice-consistent ways. And if we feel like we're threatened in some way, so if we fear that terrorists are going to blow up our country, or if we fear we're stressed.
Yeah.
So threat, fear, stress, tiredness, all of those things increase our likelihood to act in prejudicial ways. And also it doesn't even have to happen to you. It could be happening to other people. It could be something amplified in the media. And then all of a sudden you're thinking, oh my gosh, this is it. I was right to think these people were bad, the out group.
Right.
And then you begin to act in discriminatory ways.
So Sham, in the final 2 minutes that we have, how do I get around this? If this is unconscious, how do I stop myself from behaving or thinking this way?
So one of the things that we do to inoculate people against these biases and falling for these heuristics is to make them aware of these biases. So a fundamental origin of a lot of these biases come from sources. So many of us, for example, ignore the fact that we get information from a variety of sources of different levels of credibility. And so we sometimes tend not to pay attention to sources in our social media feeds, where in fact fake news breeds in a very fertile way. And so we need to make sure that people are paying attention to the kinds of sources, even when it comes to political viewpoints, whether this is a left-leaning source or a right-wing source. Being made aware of these different source attributes can go a long way in helping adjust one's way of consuming or calibrating the information that's coming in.
That is media studies professor Sham Sunder, excuse me, Sham. He is from Penn State, and we also spoke with Kennesaw State psychology professor Roxanne Donovan. Roxanne and Sham, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. But if you have an example of this, maybe a cognitive bias that you're aware of rather than being unconscious, I'd love to hear it, and especially a time when you changed your mind successfully. Because that's a relatively rare event. You know how to reach us. It's 404-500-9457. You can also reach us on Twitter at OST Talk or on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.